Welcome to the world of the strange, the mystical, and the unknown. Jerry Pippin's Parazone.
Coachman! Coachman! What is it? Where are we?
You are nearing your destination, young hare. This is the Borga Pass.
There were black, rolling clouds overhead, and in the air the heavy, oppressive sense of thunder. Now, we were through the pass.
The young hare is not expected after all.
You are early tonight, my friend.
A caleche with four horses had drawn up beside us.
Let me help you, sir.
The coachman smiled, and the lamplight fell on a hard-looking mouth with very red lips and sharp-looking teeth as white as ivory. We began to move. I looked back. The coach and its load of passengers had vanished from sight. We swept into the darkness of the pass. I struck a match. It was within a few minutes of midnight. And then a dog began to howl somewhere far down the road. The wind was rising, moaned and whistled through the rocks, and the branches of the trees clashed together as we swept along. It grew colder and colder still, and fine powdery snow began to fall. The baying of wolves sounded nearer and nearer, as though they were closing round us on every side. We kept on ascending, always ascending. The howling of wolves was growing less. Presently, it ceased altogether. And just then, the moon broke through the black clouds, and by its light, I saw round us a ring of wolves running alongside the carriage, in silence, with white teeth and lolling red tongues, with long sinewy limbs and shaggy hair.
Welcome to my house.
I must have fallen asleep. The carriage had pulled up in the courtyard of a vast ruined castle. The coachman was nowhere to be seen.
Welcome to my house. Come freely, go safely, and leave something of the happiness you bring.
Count Dracula?
I am Dracula.
His face was strong, very strong, aquiline. The mouth, so far as I could see under the heavy mustache, was fixed and rather cruel looking, with peculiarly sharp white teeth.
You hear me, Mr. Harker?
The wolf?
The children of the night, as you say, Mr. Harker. The wolves. Listen. Come now. There are many things you must tell me tomorrow. Of England and of the estate there you have purchased for me.
Yes.
The estate is called Carfax, I believe.
Yes, that is so.
But now I will detain you no longer. You will find your room in readiness. And I advise you not to leave it during the night.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Parazone. I'm Jerry Pippin. That was Orson Welles from the Mercury Radio Theater back in the late 30s and his version of Dracula. Dracula. There's something about that story, about the vampire, that creates images of fear in all of us. Our guest is Leslie Klinger. He's known throughout academia as an expert on 19th century English literature, especially Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. We caught him in Chicago at a hotel just before he was ready to leave for Washington, D.C. He has a great book out, The New Annotated Dracula. This is a great collection of everything you ever wanted to know about Dracula. Welcome to the show, Leslie. So you're going to lecture at the Smithsonian.
Yes, indeed. And then the New York Public Library.
You're in Chicago. What'd you do? A lecture last night?
Yes, at the Newberry Library.
I'm looking at my copy of the New Annotated Dracula. This is an incredible book, Leslie. It's got everything anybody would ever want to know about Dracula.
Well, I have this. I was a great Trivial Pursuit player. I loved the game, and endlessly delicious minutia is the expression that Christopher Morley used about this sort of thing. Yeah, and that's my taste. So what I tried to do here, somebody described it as adding a bonus track to a DVD. That's a good description. I tried to enrich the experience of the original book.
Yeah, you. When did you first get interested in Dracula?
Oh, when I was in college, I read the book, and it was a great surprise to me that I was so scared. I figured this dusty old Victorian tome couldn't have any real power in the 1960s, but it scared the heck out of me. And then in the 1970s, Leonard Wolfe put out an annotated edition of Dracula, and I grabbed that, and really have been interested in it ever since. And it really ties in very strongly to my interest in Sherlock Holmes. I like to think that Holmes and Dracula may well have walked the streets of London together. They were exactly contemporary.
Well, Leslie, I know you're an expert on Sherlock Holmes and Dracula, Sherlock Holmes, same time period.
Right. Yes, yes. The Bram Stoker's Dracula was published in 1897, kind of a little hiatus for Holmes, but the Sherlock Holmes stories were immensely popular in the early 1890s, and then again when the series resumed in 1901.
Bram Stoker, interesting name. Tell me a little bit about the author.
An interesting man, especially interesting because you sort of wonder, where did this book come from? I have an answer for that, which we'll get to. But Stoker started out as a journalist. He was writing theater reviews. In the course of that, he met Henry Irving, the great actor of that era. And Irving invited him to come to London to be the acting manager of his theater. Irving had taken over the Lyceum Theater and had a repertory company there. And Stoker did that. And for 25 years, he worked together with Irving. And so he was really in the center of the literary and artistic world of London there. He was friends with Arthur Conan Doyle and Robert Barr and James M. Barrie and so on. That whole crowd of English Victorians who were friends, and the leading, Rudyard Kipling, the leading writers of the day.
Now, Stoker was a pretty good writer himself. I mean, he wrote a lot of stuff, didn't he?
He has written a number of books. He wrote 18 other books, and they're all pretty forgettable. They're minor romances and adventure stories and a few travel logs, and then this masterpiece. So, you know, it's just an oddity. Now, I came up with a kind of a crackpot explanation. Stoker, in the introduction to the Icelandic edition, the first foreign language edition of Dracula, says, he confesses, this is a true story. I was given the papers by my friends, all the letters and journals and newspaper clippings and telegrams that make up the book, and I just organized them into the structure of this narrative. So that explains it. He didn't really write the book. It's a true story.
Leslie, do you buy into that?
Well, Sherlockians for a century have played the game that Holmes and Watson were really alive and that the stories are true. It's a game. And I decided to play the game here with Stoker and to take him at his word. I don't think it's disrespectful. I think that it is a tribute to the genius, the stroke of genius behind this book, that it is got so much, what's the word, verisimilitude. It's so much like real life, with, of course, the injection of a vampire into it, that we can play this game and feel comfortable.
Most of us here on planet Earth have heard about Dracula by now. Transylvania, that always piqued my imagination. Is there such a place?
There is, but interestingly, Transylvania doesn't have any vampire folklore. Many countries do, and in the 16th and 17th century, there were a number of sightings of vampires, official reports of vampires. Now, what was going on here? Well, there'd be a problem in the local village. The cattle might be dying, or, you know, the crops are failing, or something going on, and someone would say, maybe it's the spirit of Uncle George, who died a few weeks ago, troubling us. Let's go look. So they'd go out to Uncle George's grave and they'd dig him up, and what they might find is that Uncle George's hair had continued to grow, and his nails had continued to grow, and there was red fluid on his lips, and maybe when they opened his coffin, there was a groaning sound that came from him, and his arm moved.
Hmm.
Well, what was going on here was, of course, the normal decomposition uh-huh. of a human cadaver, but they didn't really understand that. So they'd put a wooden stake, or in some countries an iron stake, through the corpse, and sure enough, Uncle George wouldn't trouble them anymore, and they'd report that they'd taking care of that vampire. Well, so that evolved into a tradition, a literature. In the 19th century, there were two other great English Victorian and earlier stories about vampires. One is called The Vampire by John Polidori, written at the same time as Frankenstein, and coming out of really the same little dinner party that produced Frankenstein. Polidori was a friend of Lord Byron's and of Percy Shelley and Mary Shelley, and they all wrote scary stories at night. Polidori's was The Vampire. It was a very successful book. It introduced the concept of the kind of the gentleman vampire. In the middle of the 19th century, a book was published called Varney the Vampire, written by Thomas Rymer, the same man who wrote Sweeney Todd. And it, too, was very, very successful, and it, too, starred a gentleman vampire. So when Stoker set out to write Dracula, he probably was aware of that tradition. He certainly knew the Irish folklore of vampires. He heard that from his mother. And he drew on a lot of those traditions, but he did invent some of his own aspects of vampires as well. And we can see that process going on in the fascinating notes that he kept over the seven-year period that he was writing the book.
He kept notes about his writing. In other words, he wrote notes about how he was writing it?
He wrote notes that were outlines of the chapters, outlines of the structure of the book, lists of characters, copious research notes. He would copy out from other books things that he found interesting. He kept a list of all the books he consulted. And all of these papers, known as the Stoker Notes, are available to scholars at the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia. They've just been published in a facsimile version as well, so that anybody now can get it through Amazon or their local bookstore and spend their own time looking at these notes and studying the construction of the book.
7 years is a long time to take to write a book, but it turned out to be a masterpiece.
It is a long time, but he was a busy man. He was busy running the theater company that I described, and the writing was a hobby. He did it on vacation. He did it like I do. You know, he did it on vacations, and he did it on holidays, and some of it, for example, he did in the town of Whitby, where he had frequently traveled with his family. It's a nice little beach town and resort town in northern England, and he set part of the book there.
I started to say it now. That sounds pretty familiar. When we talk about, you know, you really got my interest when you said it was a true story and he had notes and he just kind of assembled them. Is there any evidence that that was true?
Well, he said
it was true.
Right. He said it was true. It's hard for you on the radio to see my wink, but, you know, who knows? I teach a course.
I mean, he was in show business, so he's
right.
Probably aware of PR.
Well, I like to say that I like to spin out the idea that Jonathan Harker was also a young lawyer, as was Stoker. Stoker was a lawyer too, and they probably met when they were both studying for the bar. And I can just picture Harker having these papers, wanting somebody to help him write them up, and he says to Bram Stoker, "You, my friend, you're an experienced writer. Maybe you can help us with this." Now, when I teach my class on Sherlock Holmes, usually after the first hour of my carrying on in the similar vein here, some student puts his or her hand up and says, "Mr. Klinger, I'm confused. Is Sherlock Holmes real or fictional?" And my answer is always, yes.
A little of both, huh?
A little of both.
Can we say that about Dracula?
Well, certainly. I love to quote Vincent Starrett, the great bookman, who said, "Only those things the heart believes are true."
There was something about this whole concept of Dracula. As you mentioned, it wasn't necessarily original with him, but it scared the gee willies out of you.
Absolutely.
And when I remember reading it, And then it spurred all kinds of movies and things. What do you think is the connection there? I guess we all have an innate fear of vampires.
I think it's a combination of a lot of factors. First of all, we're all fascinated. I mean, throughout history, humans have been fascinated by death, blood, and of course, we'd all like the idea that death can be overcome, or even that one could be immortal, as Dracula appears to be. But I think the appeal of the vampire figure itself is an appeal to the lonely outsider, the other, if you will. When I say appeal, both a fear of the other, the outsider, and to some extent an identification with that. We all feel somewhat alone, estranged, nobody understands us, and the vampire epitomizes that. And when we talk about the films, Jerry, we're going to see that the image of the vampire really changed over the 20th century from the monster that's the vampire, or that's Varney the Vampire or Dracula, to a much different image in the current times.
Oh, in fact, some of these vampires are created in modern media that are pretty likable, and they're designed that way.
Yes. So the progress went like this. Dracula himself is a monster. I mean, when we read the descriptions of him in the book, he's a tall, old man with long, sharp nails, teeth that protrude over his lips, hair on his palms, and bad breath. Now, the bad breath, of course he has bad breath. He's a corpse. But this is a monster. And the first film, Nosferatu, that came out in 1922, showed Dracula that way, as a really scary, monstrous creature.
Was that a U.S. movie? Or?
No, it was made in Germany, made by the great German director, F.W. Murnau. It's a silent film. It's pretty widely available on the Internet. And it's really a powerful film. Now, this film also introduced the idea that sunlight was injurious to vampires. That's not in the book, but Murnau thought that that really worked well, and in that film, the first of many, the vampire is destroyed by the dawn, by the sunlight.
Yeah, one of my favorite ones is, I believe it was a Hammer film or from England. Or one
The Horror of Dracula with Christopher Lee. And
yes, that's it, where he disintegrates right at the end.
Right. Only to come back.
Yes.
In the next film, anyway. So that was the monster vampire. But in 1927, a stage play was created from the book with the permission of Stoker's widow. And Hamilton Dean was the producer. And he cast in the role of Dracula a man named Raymond Huntley. Huntley was a tall, good-looking figure, slick back hair. He wore the opera cape, the white tie and tails that have become so familiar. The play went to America, was a huge success on Broadway, starred an unknown actor named Bela Lugosi. When the film was made in 1931 by Universal, by Carl Laemmle Jr., he didn't want to cast Lugosi. He looked hard for another actor to play the part, but he ended up reluctantly casting Lugosi in the part. Lugosi, of course, nailed down that image permanently. The good-looking, you know, sort of darkly attractive, very seductive, I call him almost a lounge lizard kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
And that evolved to prettier and prettier vampires. We have Frank Langella.
Let's talk about Bela Lugosi for
sure.
A minute. He seemed to me that he in real life is a caricature.
Well, he was an interesting man. He was a great, supposed to have been a great actor in his native Hungary, and then came here, didn't really do very well with English. It's said that he learned his lines for the film phonetically, and did a wonderful job in that part, but the critics hated him. The critics thought he had no acting ability at all. He came across, they said, like a cross between a wooden Indian and a mortician. And unfortunately, after Dracula, he was stuck in one bad film after another, sort of repeating the same role. The highlight, maybe the low light, being Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, the Wolfman, and Dracula.
It's interesting when you mention Abbott and Costello. I remember that movie, and when it first came out, I'm a pretty old guy. I was very young at the time, but Lugosi, he seemed like he was perfect for to play off of, you know?
Yes. And he really did become the iconic Dracula. I mean, everyone who has played Dracula since, in some way, has at least either paid homage or imitated him outright.
I never really was scared of him as Dracula, but some of those some of those Dracula portrayals were almost as scary as the novel.
Yes, darn scary. I mean, Christopher Lee is a great Dracula in the series of Hammer films. The films are not very good, but he's terrific. Frank Langella was, to my taste, much too pretty a guy to play Dracula, and there were many other pretty boys who played him as well. My favorite two films are the BBC production of Dracula in the 1970s that starred Louis Jourdan. Unfortunately, Jourdan is much too good-looking, but the film is very close to the original book. And the Jack Palance version that was made for television in the 1970s. He's really a great combination of sort of rugged good looks and really scary.
I remember that. You're right. He probably is the best of the Draculas. They're pretty close to it.
Yeah. And so then the image continued to change. I mean, we got comedy in the form of the only suntan vampire out there, George Hamilton.
I remember that.
Leslie Nielsen and Mel Brooks' wonderful Dracula, Dead and Loving It. And films like, I mean, I think the film Blackula is a much underrated film. I think it's actually a quite good film with the wonderful William Marshall as Dracula. He's not really Dracula, he's a prince of Africa who has been turned into a vampire. Then we get to the sort of the last stage. We get to the modern vampires, Count Saint Germain from the Quinn Yarborough long series of books, Anne Rice's vampires, the Buffy vampires,
sure.
Spike and Angel. These are heroes now. Not only are they romantic, seductive, they're now actually good guys. And I think the vampire has been transformed almost like the cowboy myth, so that we now see this attractive loner. I like to picture the vampire riding off into the sunset on his horse with a canteen of blood.
He's got a quart of blood on his side there, but instead
yep.
of a fly.
Exactly.
Right. The stage presentations, anything recent going on with Dracula?
Well, yes. There's a ballet of Dracula that's been touring widely. There's an opera version that's been out there. And there are numerous stage plays. And I get my Google News for all the references to Dracula that pop up, but I'm amazed at how many theater productions there are probably, of course, for Halloween, but going on right now all over America.
Yeah, when we talk about, I guess, the purist, like you, you're a serious researcher, a literary person.
Serious, I hope.
Yeah, does this bother you that it's gone, this whole gamut?
Not a bit. I feel the same way about this that I do about Sherlock Holmes. It's sort of any appreciation is good appreciation. Any attention paid to Dracula is good attention.
You don't really believe that there are vampires, do you? Or do you?
Well, I'm just not sure. I guess I'm not prepared to say categorically there aren't. But
we've done stories about people that have to have blood and for
somebody asked me a great question, Jerry. What was the scariest thing I found in the course of my research? And I said the scariest thing I found was a magazine published in England called Bite Me. This is a current magazine. I mean, you can still subscribe to it.
Mm-hmm.
About the vampire lifestyle. About
wow.
all the goth.
Yeah.
Dances, where to get your teeth fixed to be vampiric looking, where to get the red contact lenses, ads for personal ads for couples into consensual blood sharing. There's a whole vampire sub lifestyle out there. And
it's scary just thinking about that.
I think yes, that scares me more than anything.
I wonder what their circulation is.
I don't know, I know that that's going on in America too. There have been some interesting books studying the vampire subcultures in America.
How did we get from the old man with the bad teeth, bad breath, and long fingernails to good-looking vampirist type people. You know what I mean? The ladies who are vampires.
Sure. Well, I think that there's a great deal of sexual implications in the original book. It's not, this isn't a perversion of the story, if you will. I think the Victorians probably saw the original book as kind of softcore porn. The reviews that came out thought it was thrilling but disgusting. And I'm sure that some readers said, oh, I better get that.
Yes.
And there's a lot of sharing of bodily fluids in there. There's a real seductiveness that comes across in the book as Dracula's victims are not, he doesn't just jump on them, he seduces them, he mm-hmm. enthralls them. And, you know, we all, I think, have a dark side of us that would like to be forced to do bad things. The bad boy, the appeal of the bad boy or the bad girl. And I think this book calls out to that.
When we talk about the future of vampires and Dracula, it looks like it's been going on for a long time now, what, 140 years or so?
Yeah, and it doesn't seem to be letting up.
No.
There was an announcement in the press a few weeks ago that a sequel to Dracula is going to be written by the great-grandson of Bram Stoker, and a major publisher is going to bring it out. There are various films in various stages of production, as always. There seems to be, Dracula, by the way, is the second most filmed person ever, the first most being Sherlock Holmes.
Really?
Yes.
And you're into both of them.
You know, I'm an easy mark.
Yeah. And movie companies ever contact you?
Oh, indeed. I've read a lot of scripts.
You got anything that you wanted to get involved with? I guess not yet.
Well, there's a fine Sherlock Holmes film being made right now by Guy Ritchie with Robert Downey Jr. as Sherlock Holmes. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I don't know of any Dracula productions at the moment that sound interesting.
Let's get back to the original novel. Do you remember one of the scenes or anything that just still stands out in your memory?
Well, there's several. The scene that I find, and I find many people remember as the scariest scene, or the one that sort of freaked them out the most, was the one where Jonathan Harker is trapped in the castle and of Dracula. Dracula has imprisoned him there. And he looks out the window of his room, and it's a beautiful countryside, and he turns his head, and he sees Dracula crawling head down the side of the castle wall like a giant lizard with his cape spread out behind him. And it's just this so inhuman, this scene. It's just so impossible that it terrifies Jonathan and it terrifies readers.
With that, we're going to let you go. At the Smithsonian, they're interested in Dracula or Sherlock Holmes. And
they're interested in all those sorts of things. I gave a talk there a few years ago about Sherlock Holmes. Tonight is talking about the changing image of the vampire, and I'm going to be showing film clips from some of the very films that we've talked about.
You got a favorite film clip you like?
Well, yes, but it's on the comedic side. I have low taste. In the Mel Brooks film, there's a wonderful scene where Jonathan Harker is being led to Lucy's crypt by Van Helsing, and he doesn't quite get the concept that she's a vampire, so he looks down in the coffin and he says, "She's dead," and Van Helsing says, "No, she's undead. She's Nosferatu." And Harker looks at him and says, "She's Italian?"
With that, we'll leave it. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Jerry.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
From Bram Stoker's Dracula. As I leaned from the window, my eyes was caught by something moving a story below and somewhat to my left, where I imagined, from the order of the rooms, that the windows of the Count's own room would be there. The window at which I stood was tall and deep, stone mullioned, and though weather-worn, was still complete. But it evidently was many a day since a case had been there. I drew back behind the stonework and looked carefully out. What I saw was the Count's head coming out. I did not see the face, but I know the man
by the neck and the movement of his shoulders and his back and his arms. In any case, I could not mistake the hands, but my very feelings changed to repulsion and terror when I saw the whole man slowly emerge from the window and begin to crawl down the castle wall, face down with his cloak spreading around him like great wings. At first, I could not believe my eyes. I thought it was some trick of the moonlight, some weird effect of shadows. But I kept looking, and it could be no delusion. He was moving downward with a considerable speed, just as a lizard moves along the wall. What manner of man is this? Or what manner of creature is it in the semblance of a man? I feel only terror and fear, but I dare not think of it. The story of Dracula. Man, monster, myth, the vampires. They may be with us.